Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes a place sacred, and how do the strong emotions that arise in such places manifest themselves in those who don't hold religious faith? When travel writer and novelist Colin Thubran undertook his latest expedition, his spirits were clouded by the recent death of his mother, which left him the only living member of his family. He set out for one of the world's most remote holy places, the towering Himalayan peak of Mount Kailash in Tibet, which is held in such reverence that it has never been climbed. Instead, Hindu, Jain, Buddhist, and Bon pilgrims brave altitude sickness and extreme physical challenge to trek around its base, usually in a day or two. Colin Thubran's new memoir about his own experiences at Kailash is called To a Mountain in Tibet. Colin, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
You were aware of Kailash long before you decided to travel there, but until you saw it for yourself, it hadn't seemed completely real to you. Can you talk about that?
An Indian woman told me years ago about this strange mountain north of the main Himalayan range and told me I must go there. And I put it right at the back of my mind. I'd hardly heard about it. And it was only really the death of my mother that, for some reason, I find quite hard to explain, made me want to go.
Now, there are some people who report that they have experiences of seeing their dead loved ones on the trip. You didn't expect this to happen, did you?
No. No, my journey, I mean, I'd love to make a sort of narrative from it that was in some way cathartic or redemptive. Or something. It wasn't really like that. Mm-hmm. I regarded it more as a journey of science, sort of meditation, if you like, and something that I think quite a lot of people in grief want to do something very physical. And I like the idea of walking. And of course, I like the idea of going to somewhere that was holy. But I also like the idea that the mountain was like a beautiful and sacred object in the landscape rather than being, you know, tied to sort of dogmas in the sense that, you know, if I'd gone to Jerusalem, I'd have thought that.
Yeah. It really is spectacular to look at. Can you talk about how it differs from the peaks that surround it?
There are almost no peaks that surround it. It's detached from the main Himalaya to the north, and it rises almost like, and we can understand how it's holy, because it seems to have been put there by some divine intent. It's standing alone above these two brilliant blue lakes, one of them the highest freshwater lake of its size on Earth, up at 15,000 feet. So it looks like a dome when you see it from afar. It's only as you get nearer and walk around it that you realize it's actually a pyramid.
And is that like the one that the Buddha's mother is supposed to have cleansed herself in before she conceived him?
The lake is that, yes. It's sacred again both to Hindus and to Buddhists. The Buddha's mother, Buddhists believe, bathed there before giving birth to him. And the Hindus believe that Shiva, it's sacred to the great god Shiva, who floats there as a golden swan, they say. So it's holy to both faiths.
And depending on people's religious faith, they move around the mountain in this ritual journey called a kora, is that correct?
That's right. They go clockwise around the mountain if they're Hindus and Buddhists. If they're Bon, which is the very old religion of Tibet, they go anti-clockwise.
What happens when people meet each other along the way going the opposite direction? Do they smile and nod? Do they stop and chat if they have a common language?
They probably have some sort of common language if they're Tibetan Buddhist. But there are very few Bon, and I never saw any coming the other way, so I don't know. Most of the people coming anti-clockwise were unfortunately Hindu pilgrims who had failed to go around the high pass around the mountain, which is 18,600 feet, it's very high. And many of the Hindu pilgrims who come from lowland India found it impossible. So they had been coming back very sadly, usually on horses, or yaks even, in the opposite direction.
We should talk about the altitude and how this affects people. Even if you're not climbing this mountain, altitude sickness is a real danger.
Yes. Altitude sickness is no respecter of fitness, age, gender, anything. It can hit anybody. And I didn't know. I hadn't been above 15,000 feet before. and I didn't know how it would affect me, so I was just sort of taking my chances. But in the Tibetans, because of their lungs and blood structure, are able to go around almost effortlessly at tremendous speed. You'd see these pilgrims going around, sometimes with small children and animals, and going around this circuit, which is some 33, 34 miles at high altitude. They do it in 36 hours. Hmm. Others, Westerners and Hindus, would take 4 days.
So is this considered an act of worship or of meditation or of penance? Why do people decide to make this pilgrimage?
All of those, I think. For some, it is an act of penance for something they have done. Some even will go around the whole mountain, prostrating themselves all the way, and that takes a month. For others, they do it for merit, for good karma, so that the weight of their bad karma is relieved by going around the mountain. It carries great benefits in that way. Or they do it for something absolutely practical. You know, Tibetan Buddhists may do it because, you know, they want another yak, or they want to give, you know, give birth to a son, or something. But it's often quite practical what they're asking for.
And I guess people of different faiths respect one another's traditions around the mountain. There's not a sort of competition among them.
No, it's a holy land in a way. There's no, or said to be, or meant to be, no anger, no antagonism. In that way, it's rather like, say, the ancient Greeks of Olympus. This was a land of peace where people come together in harmony. That's been a tradition. In its great lakes, nobody fishes them, nobody hunts there, and people go around in perfect amity.
I want to talk about this, though. Westerners are drawn to Tibet because it has this mystical, almost mythological vision. It presents this vision to us that you think, you know, is not entirely accurate. Can you talk a little bit about the dangers of romanticizing Tibet too much?
Well, it's easy to do because it's such an isolated country. And certainly in the 19th century, it was completely sort of forbidden. It was very hard to get into. So, as with all places that are inaccessible, a kind of romance grew up about them as what they might be, what they might hold. And, of course, it was a land almost uniquely governed by monks, which gave it a sacred aura. But in the West, people vested their fantasies in it. There were, particularly in the late Victorian period and right into the 20th century, far into the 20th century, people were imagining it as a place where the monks had special powers. You know, they could levitate and fly, and they could break rocks with their voices and perform extraordinary feats of mental cognition and so on. And so all these fantasies grew up because people wanted to believe that this place was a sort of unique, really. It was a leftover, something that, because of its being so enclosed by mountains, so protected, had preserved in itself something very pure, a very pure kind of Buddhism. And I think that, you know, when the Dalai Lama fled in 1959, a lot of that mystique got sort of disseminated to the West in a way. Mm-hmm. And people found it harder to believe in that. It was almost as if the land had been contaminated by the Chinese invasion. But I think, you know, if we're more honest about it, it's a terribly poor land. It always has been. And there's a lot of superstition there. And there's a lot of, you know, the life expectation in Tibet until very recently was just 36. Life was very hard. And the monks, theocracy of monks who were ruling it was often not particularly benign at all. And the more distant history of Tibet is one of quite a belligerent empire, even.
Even today, it is difficult to get permission to go. It's in a disputed territory, but the Chinese government essentially controls it. What did you have to do to get permission to travel around the mountain?
I simply had to be persistent through an agent in Kathmandu who went on with the complicated business of getting me several different visas, where I was a, not exactly a military area, but it's militarily sensitive, and you have to get a permit not just to enter Tibet, but to go around the mountain at all, and also to get yourself accepted by the military. And so all that, I'm afraid, I delegated to an agent in Kathmandu. It would be too wearisome, really, to go into, particularly after the riots over the Olympics in Lhasa. The Chinese have become more sensitive to foreigners wandering about in Tibet.
And they don't want solo travelers. Why is that?
I think they find solo travelers harder to control. If there's a group, the Chinese are used to groups, and that they feel is more controllable. But just a single person wandering about, might, there's a feeling they might just disappear and cause trouble.
So you sort of attached yourself initially to a group of tourists and then separated from them, is that right?
Yes. I traveled to Mount Kailash through western Nepal, a very beautiful river valley, the Kanali, which is the highest source of the Ganges. And on the border, I'd arranged to meet a group of British trekkers who were a day or two behind me. And we went over all together so that the Chinese assumed me to be part of a group. And then we separated again on the far side.
Is there a point when you get further and further in that you stop seeing so many foreigners?
There is, but actually on Mount Kailash, particularly since this was the Buddhist holy month of Sagadawa, there was a big congregation of Tibetan Buddhists and quite a number of German and Austrian trekkers and even two Russians, as well as the group that I was with, was six British people. So there was a number of toughish trekkers, I'd say.
Is that frustrating to keep running into people? In a time when you really feel like you want to be alone?
I did want to be alone. I managed to be alone almost all the time, but it was a little frustrating. Of course, you hope to see something very pure, something that tourism or traveling Western travelers haven't touched. And that you don't quite see.
Now you did hire a cook and a guide. Can you talk about how you found them? Was it again through the agency in Kathmandu?
They found the Sherpa for me, who was a guide, young man, and the cook, the horseman, who was the third member of our party. We had to find in this area of Humla, this remote roadless area of Tibet, of Nepal.
Typically, when you travel, you try to learn at least a speaking amount of the local language. In this case, you didn't. Did that make it more difficult for you in some ways to sort of make your way around?
Yes, it did. Tibetan is a very difficult language, and I didn't attempt to learn it. I speak Mandarin a bit, which, of course, is very unpopular to speak in Tibet.
Yeah.
But once or twice, I communicated with people through Mandarin. It was a great difficulty. In Nepal, of course, my Sherpa was an interpreter. He knew Nepali, and he was able to communicate with people. But once over the border, I had hired him because he was a Taman, who were Nepalese people, quite close to the Tibetans, and their language is quite close. And I was hoping he might be able to interpret conversations with Tibetans for me, but he couldn't, and the dialects are so difficult, he couldn't understand a word any more than I could.
Novelist and travel writer Colin Thubrin is my guest. His newest book is called To a Mountain in Tibet. We'll resume our conversation with Colin in a moment, and you're welcome to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is the novelist and travel writer Colin Thurbrunn. His new book is called To a Mountain in Tibet. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Colin, after the death of your mother, you were faced at home with the burden of going through your parents' things. And this is photographs and diaries and love letters. What sort of correspondence did your parents have while your father was away at war?
Well, my father was a professional soldier during the Second World War, and he was in North Africa and Italy. And my mother didn't see him for a year and a half, I think it was at least. And they corresponded there very touchingly. My father's, of course, letters were censored, so he had to be careful. There's very little about the war in it, or only in sort of odd little bits. And even when he was at Anzio, which was one of the big landings of the American and British armies in Italy, and they were sort of stranded on this beachhead, he would write to my mother. These letters appear in which he mentions the birds singing and the flowers and things, but then would say, well, there's not too many birds because of the shells that are exploding. And they're very touching. He's reminded of her by a certain kind of bird. And he's always reflecting on home and longing to be home, longing for peace, as my mother was, and as soldiers so much were. Particularly towards the end of the war, they could feel that peace was coming. And it's a very touching correspondence, and that was very hard to read. I hesitated to read my parents' letters to one another. It seemed intrusive, and at the same time, I felt a tremendous curiosity. Hmm. And because of the quality of the letters, I didn't in the end feel I was being too much of an intruder.
Were they both good writers?
Different. My mother was a very emotional and rather impassioned writer. My father, he was very observant, but much more controlled, and much more, he was a military man, mm-hmm. Much more ordered in his writing, I'd say.
It must be interesting as well, if you don't mind my saying, you're in your early 70s, to look back to a time in your parents' lives when they are much younger than you are today.
It was strange because I think we all consider that our parents are forever older than us.
Yeah.
And to read their correspondence when they were much younger and to get a sense of them as young people is something that hardly ever happens, I think. Our parents are always older than we are. And even when I look at photographs of them as young, much younger than me, I'm almost seeing them sort of bifocally, as if I can see they're young people. And yet they're my parents still, and therefore older. And it's quite a confusion.
And you write about the fact that on this journey, you often felt as if it was as much a journey through time as through physical space. You yourself felt young at certain points and all of your years at others.
And all the time.
You felt all of your years at some points, and other times you felt like you were the same person you'd been as a very young man.
Yes. I felt a bit timeless in a curious way. I wouldn't say it's a sort of mystical thing. I don't know what it was, but sometimes I felt very light. Sometimes I felt I was sort of slipping back in my memory. Sometimes I was reminded, because I was thinking about my family, who were dead all the time, I was reminded of them at different stages of their own lives. Mm. And so it was in that sense journey of meditation over time.
And your parents died when they were elderly, but your sister, you lost your sister when you were both quite young, which is a different sort of experience because then that person becomes frozen in time in a really different way.
Yes. My sister was killed in an avalanche at the age of 21. I was just 19. And I was reminded of this very forcibly because the north face of Kailash is likened to the north face of the Eiger at Grindelwald, which is where my sister died. Mm-hmm. And walking under this very frightening north face of the mountain, of course, put me in mind of her in particular over the years.
Yeah, it's strange to think about, you know, the power of mountains to be sort of, you know, healing in a spiritual sense and also very dangerous.
Yes, I think mountains have always, well, not always, but for several centuries, been thought of as not just beautiful, but divine. They've always been thought of the abode of the gods, as it were. Dangerous, yes. Kailash, parts of it look almost unscalable and probably are. The north face is 5,000 feet, just a sheer drop out of nothing. And it's never been climbed because of its holiness, and it might be very difficult to climb. I'm not sure. But the sanctity of mountains, I think, is sort of almost implicit in human, even in human language. We talk about progressing upwards, ascending is always to be making progress. Nobody progresses downwards. And there's a very old feeling, I think, a pilgrimage feeling, that to be going up is to be approaching divinity.
Colin Thubrin is my guest. His new book is called To a Mountain in Tibet. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Arthi in Keller. Hi, Arthi.
Hi. I'm calling from Keller, Texas, and I thought I'll share something about Mount Kailash. It is a journey that I'm still yet to undertake, and I hope to, and I'm hoping it will happen as soon as possible, and I want my children also to go along with me. Mount Kailash, for Buddhists, for Hindus, it is Manasarovar. It is where we undertake this pilgrimage to humble ourselves. It's like looking at the Grand Canyon or looking at something that's so big than you that it humbles you and you realize you are nothing but nature. And what the comment was about it, that if it's bigger than you and it is dangerous, I guess if it is dangerous, it was meant to be, but we are still part of nature. And thanks a lot for sharing this information about Mount Kailash. You've touched a very sensitive nerve, and it's such a beautiful experience just listening to this conversation.
Well,
thank you.
Thank you so much for your call, and Arthi, I hope you make it soon. That's such an interesting observation that she had, that you have this sense of humbling. Arthi is clearly aware of what she might expect to experience there, but recognizes that won't manifest itself until she goes there in person.
No, it's impossible, I think, to envisage and experience. You know, you can't look at it on a screen or even look at it on a movie and imagine it. You have to subject yourself to it. And what she says about being part of the earth is very fundamental to the pilgrimage too. Buddhists in particular feel that Mount Kailash is the actual mountain itself, is virtually alive and sacred, that the stones are living. The stones are no, in fact, if you have sin or not, even. There's a tremendously powerful sense that not just that the mountain's inhabited by gods in the sort of more down-to-earth Buddhist feelings, but that the mountain itself is a sacred unit, and to be walking around it is to be treading the path of divinity all the time.
Do you think every trip to a brand new place changes the traveler?
No, no, not to a brand new place. No, it depends on the traveler, mm-hmm. and of course depends on the place. Some people have, you know, we like to think that travel broadens the mind, but it can close the mind up too if you travel with enough prejudice.
What do you take with you? What provisions do you take with you for a trip like this?
Just as little as possible, uh-huh. I usually take with me. I have a habit of laying out everything I think I'm going to need before a journey and asking myself, do I really need that? And the answer is almost always no. You actually need terribly little. In this case, of course, I was traveling with this little company, rather like British Raj, with the Sherpa, the cook, and the horseman, and we had tents. So you need the horse to put the tents on. And of course, the more people you travel with, the more equipment you want. But we, even so, we went with rather little. And at the foot of Kailash, where the really steep and difficult climbing begins, we simply shed all our belongings and took one small tent.
And the first in your party to really suffer from altitude sickness was your guide, who was 27 years old and a local.
Yes, this is crazy. You know, I was expecting to get altitude sickness coming from lowland England, but I was okay. And he, who was a Nepalese Sherpa, suddenly started getting headaches. But I realized that actually, you know, the differences of altitude in Nepal are very great. And he was really a lowlander, not far from Kathmandu. So he wasn't like the cook, for instance, who came from the Everest area. And he walked around as if he was just walking around a garden. You know, he had no difficulty at all.
Talk about this. When you are in a place that you have not been to before, are you making notes? Do you keep a diary every time you're traveling, or do you wait and sort of collect your thoughts when you get home?
No, I have to make notes. If I think that I will write about a journey, I make quite voluminous notes, notes that involve an awful lot of self-consciousness, really, which I don't like. You know, to be stopping on a journey and making notes, it seems to be rather too self-conscious. But I don't know how to escape it, because to write about a place, I need to remember detail. It's often the detail that gives life to a description, the particular phraseology that somebody had in their conversation with you, or the way their eyebrows met in the middle, or if you're looking at a piece of scenery, the texture of the rock, or all these things which seem quite small and insignificant are really important in the writing of it. And these things you just forget. My memory is absolutely average. And after a month or two of traveling, I would forget them. So it all has to go down in notes. And the notes become quite thick. My writing is very small, actually. So I pack an awful lot into just a few notebooks.
And you don't take a camera?
Not usually. I did take a camera for this, but just for reference. Where it became very cold and quite hard to write. But the last day I was close to 18,600 feet. It was very, very cold. I was just glad to have the camera to click, you know, to record little scenes when I could no longer write anything. But normally I don't take a camera, and my books aren't illustrated. The idea, I think, behind this of publishers is that the writer paints the picture for the reader, and therefore photographs are sort of unnecessary or irrelevant, because you're seeing the world through the eyes of the writer.
To a certain extent, this book is a departure from some others that you've written in the past about your journeys, because the narrative is so personal and internal. Did you hesitate at all to share this with the world and think, I can write about this trip, but not talk so much about what was going on within my head and my heart?
Yes, I did. I hesitated. I wasn't sure at all that when I was traveling that it would become a book at all. When I wrote these passages, the passages in which during the journey I was reminded of my family, I thought, well, I'll write them, but I'll probably eliminate them. I'll write them in the manuscript, but eliminate them in the published text. That was made it easier to write about it. It was very tense and rather unhappy, the writing about it, but it was something I felt I wanted to do, and that would never reach the light of day. And then when I looked at it after I'd finished, I thought, well, somehow these passages belong here. They're integral to the book. They almost become the point of the book. And so I left them in.
Do you feel like you were also grieving for the fact that the memories of the things that had taken place in your childhood, you were the only one left on Earth that would have those memories?
Yes, there was a sense of that, that I'm the last. And the last, in a way, to whom they'd be relevant. I mean, to whom really are parents' letters to one another, or their photographs, or my father's hunting records when he was in India? To whom are they relevant, really, after all their children have gone? It was a sort of sad reflection on mortality, that is so, that, you know, when I go, these things are going to be unmoored from any real memories or any association with any person that anybody can remember at all. And so there was that sadness in recollecting what it meant to be going through my parents' artifacts, their letters, their documents, their photographs. That was true.
I thought it was really interesting that you initially thought that you would burn all those letters, and then you decided to read them, and you felt like whatever you ended up doing with them ultimately felt like a sort of betrayal.
Yes, that's right. I did. These letters, I hesitated to read them because they were my parents' very personal letters, and I thought, what do I do with these? I hated to burn them without having some sense of what they were. And when I read them, I couldn't bear to burn them. I've just got them, and I don't know what to do with them. To throw them away seems like a betrayal. To keep them and read them seemed a bit like a betrayal. And I think my parents' letters during the war are different, because they have a sort of social impact and an importance, and they are easily given to somewhere like the Imperial War Museum in London, where my father's military papers are. Other things, I don't know what to do with them. But as there are many people would say, these are all history, particularly in our age when most writing is done by email. These letters are increasingly valuable. Even if they're letters of people who aren't well known, they are part of history, and they should not be thrown away. I don't know what to think about that.
Novelist and travel writer Colin Thubrin is my guest. His new book is called To a Mountain in Tibet. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, offering an information session March 15th for its CFP certificate program in Dallas, starting in April. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and travel writer Colin Thubrin. His new memoir is called To a Mountain in Tibet. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You know, Colin, having read the account and hearing you talk about, your dilemma over what to do with these letters, it strikes me that they're sacred documents to you.
Yes, obviously more important to me than to anybody else.
And there's also a poignancy to this entire trip. As you read through it, it's also the question of the people that you were mourning on this trip won't be there to mourn you when you die.
No. The trip, I think, too, in part, was a meditation on the hereafter. Mm-hmm. As an agnostic, I find it hard to believe in a specific hereafter. But the Tibetans have a very strong tradition about what happens after death. Probably the only Tibetan text that any of us have ever read is the Tibetan Book of the Dead. And in a way, I was sort of testing my own faith or lack of faith or desire about the hereafter against the Buddhist one, which is developed there.
Were you hoping that perhaps you'd come to the conclusion that there was something?
I don't think so. I'd like to say so, but I think I think I wasn't. It was more thinking around it, being made to contemplate on it, what the Buddhist tradition means, which is a much more more grand but less intense tradition than the Christian one. They believe in that all that gets carried on into the hereafter is karma, good or bad karma, not the individual, not memory.
So in some ways, it's sort of not a westernized or Christian way of thinking. It's sort of not a solution in the sense that you won't know if you're back.
It carries no comfort.
Yeah.
Because the individual is, excuse me, the individual is disappears, basically. There's no physical appearance, no emotional makeup, and above all, no memory that survives death. All that survives is the good or evil in the world. So the lesson that it attempts to teach is that the individual is of less account than we suppose it to be in Christianity. And this, you know, if you're mourning people, is of course of no comfort at all. But it's in a sense a rather grand view. And it makes you, of course, think about your own death and how relevant you are, how important you are. And I think, at least in my case, that one tends to feel one's own self is less important than those that you're mourning. I found it much easier to imagine my own extinction than to come to terms with those that I've loved. And the Buddhist tradition certainly made one think a lot about that.
Novelist and travel writer Colin Thuburn is my guest. His new book is called To a Mountain in Tibet. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. What are the first recorded accounts in history of pilgrimages to Mount Kailash?
There are very, very few. The first Westerner was a Jesuit missionary in 1715. Who remarks how the Buddhists circle the mountain for what he calls indulgences, he being a Catholic. but the probability is that people were circling the mountain 1,000 years ago because the mountain came to be associated with a mountain in Hindu scripture and in Buddhist scripture, which was supposed to be the source of all creation, where all the four great rivers of the world flowed out and nourished the world, all rose at the base of Mount Kailash. And in time, this mystical mountain became associated with Kailash, such a strange and beautiful mountain that rose beyond the normal Himalayas. And oddly enough, at the source of Kailash, all the four great rivers of the Indian subcontinent, the higher source of the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Indus, the Sutlej, they all rise within 70 miles of the summit of Kailash.
This might strike you as a strange question, but I'm curious about what it smells like there.
Smells like? Yeah. Gosh, I don't know much of a sense of smell. I can't remember any smell. but, of course, in the little temples, the tiny monasteries rather around Kailash, you get a smell of yak butter sometimes, mm-hmm. which is, they have these butter lamps. Mm-hmm. Actually, they're getting superseded now by an oil that gets sold, a vegetable oil. But there's always a slight smell of that sort of yak butter around. That's the most potent smell I can remember.
Are the monks welcoming to people who travel? Do they sort of try to keep their distance even as people pass through the areas where they live?
Difficult to say. They're welcoming enough, but they're very poor, and they're very few. They're just around Kailash. They're just these four little monasteries, and you know, only a handful of monks, perhaps three or four in each one.
And so I suppose they have sort of a relationship where everyone has some responsibility for taking care of the places where they are?
Yes, they look after these little monasteries. They were all destroyed in the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s. So they were all completely demolished. So they've all been rebuilt, and they already look old, but most of their artifacts and statues and so on were destroyed. So they've been rebuilt.
We have an email here from Dasarad who says, Mount Kailash is the home of Lord Shiva, one of the three main deities and one of the Hindu Trinity. Today is Shivaratri, night of Lord Shiva, a holy day for Hindus and celebrated all over the world. Your program is very timely. Thanks for airing it. And Dasarad wants to know if global warming has had any effect on the snow caps, because it has had an impact on the River Ganges and other rivers flowing into China.
Not noticeably. I think if you were to look at the mountain over many years, you might find that during the summer it was less snowbound, but not noticeably. It's snow-capped all the year, and indeed the summit, the snow summit, is believed by Hindus to be where Shiva contemplates eternally with his consort Parvati, and it's very lovely. There's a sort of very distinctive formation on the south face of Kailash, which looks like a stairway, as if it's somewhere for spirits or gods to move up and down. Mm. And it's lovely, but the snow does start to melt as the summer progresses, and what it leaves there on that face of the mountain is a swastika. The shadowy shape of a swastika, which so contaminated in the West, that symbol, but in the East, all through Asia, is considered a sign of good luck, of good fortune.
Is it difficult to sleep at the sort of altitude that you were traveling at?
Yes, you get lightheaded. It's quite hard to sleep, but at the same time, with the walking, you're very exhausted, so sleep happens.
Did the physical exhaustion feel good, given your grief?
Yes, it did. I think it was good. I mean, I don't want to make too much of the grief, because after all, I'm a man of 70. It's not so unusual that you have no parents or even siblings left. But I think the whole business of physical exercise was something that, for whatever reason, I wanted to do.
It is extremely fortunate that you remain in good enough shape to travel in these ways. A lot of people your age are on, you know, Alaskan cruises, and that's pretty much the extent of their ability to get around.
Yes. Well, yeah, I'm lucky. Because you fear. I've had all sorts of accidents in the past. You know, I had a back broken in a road accident. I had a bad knee cartilage since childhood. I broke an ankle in Syria. And all these things you fear are going to come back to haunt you when your body is under stress, particularly my back and my knee cartilage. I thought perhaps these are going to start really giving me pain, because if they do, there's nothing much you can do. You know, you have to know how you come down from such altitudes. But really, it was altitude sickness that worried me most, because if that happens, then you can die as 8 Indian pilgrims died on the mountain while I was there of edema or some kind of altitude sickness. And so you don't. It's something to be very frightened of, really. And they say there's no cure for it except just to come down, as if there's a nice little elevator going down from the Tibetan plateau to the Indian plain. So that was what really worried me more than a physical or muscular trouble.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Anupam in Keller. Hi, Anupam.
Hi, this is Anupam from Keller, and a very interesting show. Thanks a lot for putting it on. And I just had a comment based on what your guest said earlier about things to take on a journey and also death. So basically, death is as much a part of life as anything else. And in India, when people go on arduous pilgrimages, sometimes they even carry items for the last rites, because if they were to die on the pilgrimage, there's nothing probably more holy or auspicious than that. So dying on a mountain when you're going there for a pilgrimage is probably a very auspicious thing. You know, one of the better ways to die, in a sense, almost. Hmm. That was all. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Colin?
That's very interesting. Yes, I think it's so, that if Indians die on this pilgrimage, it may be considered a sort of blessing. The Hindus who I was most sorry for were those, in a way, not who had died, but who hadn't managed to do the whole circuit of the mountain, and who were coming back the wrong way, because because they couldn't press the 18,600-foot pass. And I have to say that some of these people had been brought out there by unscrupulous travel agents from India, and they were completely unprepared for the hardships, for the altitude, and for the strenuousness of the climb. And whereas the Indian government sends out people by lottery who go through health checks. And so it's something that that was not happy to see, that many of these pilgrims are gone with such high hopes, and an awful lot of high percentage hadn't been able to complete the circuit.
You passed by one man who was doing so badly that you felt like you wanted to, I guess, just sort of give him a hug or take him into your arms.
Yes. Oh, yes. I felt so sad for them. But very important to the Hindus, of course, is to bathe in the sacred lake at the foot of Kailash. It's more sacred to them than it is to the Buddhists even. And that was a great blessing, even if they hadn't come around the mountain.
Do you think of traveling as much as going? Is it equal parts going to somewhere and going away from somewhere else?
Oh, I suppose what fascinates me is the destination more than the movement. Travel has a wonderful kind of visual feeling which nothing else quite supplies, and that excitement to be actually on the move. But for me, above all, it's the place that I imagine, I have in my mind when reading about it, its destination. And that was so with Kailash.
You're working on your next novel now, is that right?
Yes.
Is that something, can you write anywhere, or do you sort of stay in one place when you're working on a novel?
I like to stay in one place if possible. In the end, all I require of a place is that it's silent and that it offers no distraction. So I often work in sort of small cottage in Wales, for instance, or in my partner's house here in Philadelphia. She works at the university, and it's very quiet. And so I can work pretty much anywhere. I simply go inside my head.
Do you feel like the trips you have taken always inform the novels you write, even if they're not directly related in theme?
Not necessarily, no. Some of my novels have been very sort of very much not the kind of novels which a travel writer would write. And they've been set in places where people can't move at all, one set in a prison and others in a mental hospital and so on. Others have been related to travel, so they vary. But I find they come from a different source in me. The travel books come from a fascination with the outside world, but the novels usually with something more personal.
The new memoir by novelist and travel writer Colin Thubron is called To a Mountain in Tibet. Colin, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.